is there going to be an opt-in and opt-out concept where a customer says, okay, my content can be contributed to the larger model for your benefit as long as you do that securely, or I would like to keep my content segmented. And so architectures on how we're going to handle that challenge, I think, are going to be more difficult. But definitely, we're already well ahead on the idea of what are the architectures that are going to be needed to segment private data and keep that always private.
Hello, and welcome to the DPP podcast. I'm Edward Qualtro, editorial director here at the DPP, and that was Ryan Kido, CTO at Atelier. This is the second edition of a two-parter digesting the DPP report, AI in Media, What Does Good Look Like? Along with Ryan, we will also hear from BBC solution lead Morag McIntosh, who discusses 30 years of using automation technologies at the BBC, and she shares some recent case studies about using AI to improve production processes and audience engagement in its wildlife and classical music coverage, and how those examples could be used in other areas at the corporation. First, though, the DPP's Rowan de Pomeray, author of the AI in Media report, with Atelier CTO Ryan Kido, talking about the use of AI in the end-to-end media supply chain, and how Atelier is thinking about the correct use of customer data to potentially inform a vendor's models and algorithms, and how media companies and their suppliers need to think about approaching these conversations and partnerships.
Okay, I'm here with Ryan Kido, who's the CTO at Atelier, who have generously supported this work, for which we're very grateful. But Ryan, you are also, a really kind of expert and involved contributor to this report. So I'm very interested, when you saw the outcome, when you saw the report that we published, what really resonated with you? What kind of sort of struck a chord with what you see in your business? And equally, was there anything that surprised you?
Yeah, no, thank you, Rowan, for the time today. It's great to talk about this subject. I really enjoyed the report and also the process of contributing to it and being part of the forum, is what we discussed. I think what's the hallmark of this technology is it's such a revolutionary step, and there's so many different perspectives, and it's such, I think, sort of a monumental step forward. There's a lot of sort of unease about the technology, but so much enthusiasm about the potential. And I think that's kind of where we are right now, is in between those two steps. Everyone knows, with the potential and with the opportunity, that the time is now to start moving. But how well those outcomes will work and how long it will take, with the nature of a machine learning model and AI, to kind of get to the promise on the other side is where I think most of us are. You know, we're well underway in testing some things at Atelier, and we're listening to our customer feedback. But trying to understand where those success points will be, I think, is where we are generally as an industry.
Yeah, and for anybody who isn't super familiar with Atelier, so you kind of play in that supply chain and content management and processing and fulfillment area, which we identified as kind of a key area that AI-driven automation can be very impactful. So I'm really interested, where are you investing your time and energy, and what are customers asking you for?
You know, our Connect platform right now is really strategically put on the end of that mastering process, or sort of in that mastering process through packaging and distribution and management. And honestly, we view opportunities across all three of those phases, if you will. So as we try to break down the problem in the supply chain, we try to think about what are the advancements in AI to help bring content in and prepare it and organize it? What's the way to sort of, during that management phase, to enrich it and improve it? And then how are we bringing AI to help with packaging and delivery? And so one of the big problems that we talk about on inbound is, how do we handle the metadata? So all the descriptive metadata that might be coming from Word documents or spreadsheets or external websites and systems that all have their own labels and value sets. Right now, that's an incredibly difficult process to manage and map that data in. So how do we make that really straightforward, leveraging Gen AI or other types of models to bring in content? On that sort of management side of the house, localization is a key buzzword and key area, I think, and has been an area of investigation for quite some time. You know, can Gen AI improve the meaning and intent mapping that's so difficult to get when you do a literal translation word for word from language to language? Does Gen AI help bring some of the emotive or sort of the subtleties of language into that process? to get that done better. And then packaging and distribution, these are difficult, complex workflows that take quite a bit to set up. Even in a sort of low-code system like ourselves, there's still effort to do that, and the specs are changing. So how can we leverage Gen AI to help on that back end as well?
Yeah, I think some of those data challenges are really interesting. Like it's very easy in the media industry to get caught up in everything to do with video, but actually there's so much that goes around that that it certainly struck me one of those use cases that really comes out is the ability to interpret and manage a query and understand data in so many more forms. Okay, so I've asked you with your kind of current roles hat on, but you're an interesting guy, Ryan. You know, you've worked at Sony Pictures, at Disney, at Microsoft, at Amazon. So, you know, outside of what you see within your current business, were there other areas of this that really sort of struck you as interesting?
Yeah, no, I think there's a lot of interesting things on the production side of the business in terms of the creative realm. And I think this is widely discussed, but I think that there's going to be opportunity for creative revolution, but it's going to have to be carefully managed so we don't lose track of sort of that human involvement and where the talent fits into that. You know, I think about how do you communicate a story and an intent. Usually most of us are very visual beings. So, you know, that's where AI can kind of jump in and help you, you know, tell that story. What is that storyboard going to look like? What might this world be, and build that world and be able to do new types of sort of storytelling based on that. And once you communicate that intent, you know, I think about virtual production, which is something that's been kind of growing over time. You know, how do you improve those worlds? How do you make it easier to set that up and to accommodate dynamic production? I think that's really interesting on the fixed production side. And then in live content, I think there's a huge opportunity there, whether you're talking about sort of sports and news today, how do you make them more accessible through dynamic and live translations, or through sort of overlays of data to make it more interesting and engaging, or immersive content in general. Think about something like augmented reality and VR. I think Gen AI is going to be a huge benefit there, because I think there's sort of a limit on what can be built and done sort of manually. And through the use of these tools, can you actually realize the promise of VR and the content that will be able to create to make that truly engaging and worthwhile.
Interesting. I mean, I love what you're saying about live content there, and we've certainly seen some really interesting use cases crop up. I think a couple are mentioned in the report. Some of them are sort of slightly future-looking use cases, and that makes me wonder overall, you know, what was your perspective on the sort of the gap between maturity and potential that we tried to kind of outline in the radar within the report? Are there areas that you're sort of most excited about that gap, or areas that you think we've got a bigger hill to climb?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I was reflecting on that gap the other day, and I almost feel like this path through AI is going to take some amount of grit and determination, almost like how people build skill sets. There's sort of a discussion about how humans build skills and this idea of a valley of despair where you sort of start and then you get good at something and then you kind of get bad and then you kind of have to kind of put in the effort and build till you kind of peek out of that and grow. And I think there's a sort of an irony there with the nature of machine learning and these models, where I almost feel like that's the curve we're going to have to run to kind of accomplish things. We might see initial promise and then we're going to live maybe in an 70-30, 80-20 success rate for some of these things, but we're going to need to push and invest to kind of come out the other side of that. And I think that's true for a lot of things. You're going to need that human in loop feedback and sort of time investment to kind of build and train and push that forward to kind of close those gaps. And I think that's true for something very simple, like closed captioning, live subtitles, live translations. I think that's going to be really sort of fundamental to power those things. But those have, I think, the most early and interesting promise, but it's going to take training to get there.
Yeah, and I think you're touching on one of the things that is unique and different about machine learning as a suite of technologies, that, you know, it's technology that gets better as you use it, at least in theory. And that's, you know, maybe not something that we've been used to dealing with. But of course, that comes with its own challenges. You know, one of the other things we looked at in the report was you know, how companies think about putting their data into some of these machine learning models, how they think about data leakage or security concerns, and so on. And obviously, Now, that leads to a need for some pretty clear policies from organizations. So also interested by, you know, your perspective on that. How do you think about this as a vendor, as a telco, and how are your customers thinking about, you know, the ways that they use AI and the ways that they interact with you when you've got AI in the product?
No, I think that's a really important question. We've definitely taken the security aspect of this seriously. When we think about AI, I would say we break it into two major types in our company. So one is AI for our own internal use and productivity, if you will. So the models and the tools that we'll use internally that we might train with our data that we need to make sure we keep secure. So what are these tools? What is the potential for data leakage, if you will, from those tools? How do we segment our information from the broader public model? And how do we use that securely and carefully? Separately, on the customer side, as we train this model, let's say we're leveraging their content, in that process, how do we both, again, keep that segmented from the broader world? How do we guarantee leakage? And then one of the things that we're thinking about that I honestly don't have a strong answer on is there going to be an opt-in and opt-out concept where a customer says, okay, my content can be contributed to the larger model for your benefit as long as you do that securely, or I would like to keep my content segmented. And so architectures on how we're going to handle that challenge, I think, are going to be more difficult. But definitely, we're already well ahead on the idea of what are the architectures that are going to be needed to segment private data and keep that always private, but still be able to leverage some data from the public large language models.
And something you said there that I love was something that I don't have a good answer for yet. And I think there's a lot of that in this area, yeah. Right? Stuff that smart people like yourself are thinking about, but the answers aren't yet clear. So I'm interested whether there are any other of those areas that, you know, you're putting a lot of your energy and thought into resolving to help us kind of move forward with these developments.
We talked a little bit about the training of the model and how that's going to enrich. I think one of the interesting characteristics of this technology is that your success across different libraries of content could vary based on the nature of the training. And so one of the things that I'm anticipating and thinking about, especially as we interact with customers about different AI products that they're exploring or using or that we've explored and used, is their success or their perceived success with that tool related to the tool or related to the training that's been done with that tool so far? And then how do we kind of tune that and grow that? So I think one of the things that I think a lot about is how do we have that evaluation of success and how do we tease apart, this is a model level challenge and I just need to train for success, or is this a broader technology limitation and I need to pivot around that? And I think, again, we talked about this a little bit at the top, and I think that's what makes this technology very unique in the process and building up muscle and knowledge about being able to tease apart those two different types of issues is a skill that we'll need to build along with everyone else.
Let's wrap up by just looking ahead a little bit. What are the developments on the horizon that you're most excited about in terms of the use of AI in media, in terms of video tools that build on AI?
Being part of global distribution for a long time, I think a lot about accessibility of content and how do you reach broad audiences with content that matches sort of culture and cultural intent. You know, there's compliance rules and all of those things that have to be followed, and then mapping the languages correctly as you go through that process. So I think for me, being able to all the way up in the front of the process, know what are the rights and how that can be exploited, marry that together with what's in my library, what's compliant in these areas, how do I then make that, you know, ready with a lower bar and then get it out to that market quickly? I think this technology has a unique way to try to accomplish those goals. Through automation, which I've been part of for a long time, we could make, you know, certain digital steps and turn the crank faster, if you will. But this in a way kind of allows us to almost sort of skip steps, or new steps will emerge that are different and faster. And I think it's really interesting to think about how that might change the game in terms of global distribution and global accessibility of content.
Love it. Making content accessible to more audiences more efficiently. It's a great goal. Listen, thank you so much for your time, Ryan. It's great chatting to you. And thanks again for your contribution to the report. If anybody hasn't read it yet, then what Ryan and all of the rest of the contributors have given us is some really fascinating insights. So do take a look.
And thank you, Rowan, for the time. It was great to be part of the DPP report and to contribute to good work. And I hope people find it interesting and also challenge some of our thoughts. I think that kind of feedback is always very helpful.
Okay, I'm here with Morag McIntosh, who is the solution lead for studio automation at the BBC and one of the fascinating contributors to this report, who's got some really interesting use cases. So, Morag, tell us a little bit about what your role entails and where are you using AI today in production?
So my role has me leading across studio automation and gallery control at the BBC. And the BBC was an early adopter of studio automation. We've been using it for getting on for 30 years now. And that leads us to a place where we've currently got 30 studios using a very high degree of automated control and another 10 or more studios using a lower level control with a legacy system, an in-house system that we developed all of those 30 years ago. And we carry 100 brands with that. So there are a lot of programs coming out of automated studios. We use automation across more than 20 sites, and these systems create more than 700 hours of content per week for us. And that figure is rising as we provide more and more digital content. So there is a lot to manage, and we're looking at ways of bringing AI into how systems can help us with the management of this gigantic automated estate that we've got.
Cool. And when we were in our workshops for this report, you were telling us a little bit about how you use AI with your robotic camera systems, right? Tell us about that.
Well, yeah. So management of these gallery control systems involves not only managing the systems themselves, but also managing all of the kit that the systems control and how that kit responds to our studio automation systems. So to give you an idea of the scale of that, we've got 25,000 vision mixer memories per vision mixer in each of our automated studios. And of course, it's not just vision mixers that we're controlling. We're also controlling audio desks, cameras, lights, music, media playout, graphics control, amongst other things. So we are always looking for ways to streamline our management of these systems. And this is where we have begun testing options related to AI and machine learning. So cameras are a huge part of our automated tech estates. And we've got studios with everything from just a single PTZ cam up to big flagship studios with 7 robots, tracking and elevation, VR, AR integration, and everything in between. So we've got a lot of studios, we've got a lot of programs, and we've got a lot of presenters working in those studios. And of course, not all presenters are the same height. So if you've got to create separate automation commands to recall different shots for different presenters across a large number of studios, this quickly becomes really unwieldy to support. And it makes control really difficult for users. It presents them with too many options and therefore much greater scope for error. And this is where we've been looking at AI to help. Now, I should say we're still early doors with this. We're not reliably consistently on air with it, but we have used it on air. We've used it in some of our flagship output. So the first place we're using it is in the area of face recognition. So we train the camera system on the faces of our presenters and correspondents, and we store a version of every shot in the program for each presenter and each correspondent. And all those shots are stored essentially under the same recall reference, but in a different folder for each person. So when the automation fires a shot reference, the AI is trained to recognize the face of the person currently in that shot, and it directs the camera system to go to the specific version of that shot for the person that it has recognized in the frame. And the benefit of this is really that it saves us work, as we don't need to load a large number of show files for every combination of presenter and correspondent that we've got. It means the number of camera recalls that we need to manage are reduced. And the AI can be trained to recognize people from all angles. So it can recognize people in shots from above, from below, from the side, etc. That's step one in the process. But the system also can use face positioning as part of its shot recall system. And the way this works is the system is trained to recognize where a face or a body is in the physical space and to adjust the shot accordingly to that information. So the system can tell if a person is looking left or right, and it can tell how far to one side of the frame or the other they are positioned. And within a range of tolerances set by us, the AI can tell the camera to then adjust the shot for things like looking room, headroom, or the presenter shifting position. And you can even apply some of the logic that humans would. If you've got a shot containing two people, you can tell the system to frame for the tallest one. If one of those people walks out of the frame, you can tell the system to either follow that person who's leaving or stick with the person who has stayed. And you can do things like apply dead zones to stop the camera from panning off to reveal the back of the set or something. And it works for developing shots too. For example, you might open with a big wide shot, which you don't want to adjust depending on who's in the frame, because you've lined the shot up to showcase the set and not the person. But when the camera starts zooming in, you can dictate the point at which you want it to start using face recognition and face positioning to adjust the path of the shot and its final destination so that it ends up in the optimal shot for that person. So it's really early days for us with this type of tech, and we're not there with it yet, but you can hopefully see the potential there for how we could use this sort of technology to great effect.
Yeah, very cool indeed. And I can totally imagine the scale you're operating at, that kind of efficiency saving would be huge. Okay, so I could spend another hour talking to you about that use case, but I won't, because there's some other fascinating things you've been doing. So if I recall rightly, in the sort of factual area and factual entertainment, you've been doing some really interesting things around a popular sort of nature series here in the UK, right?
Yeah, so Spring Watch, Autumn Watch and Winter Watch are a range of wildlife programmes created by the BBC. And for the past few years, the very clever people at BBC R&D have been looking at using machine learning and AI to improve editorial options and to improve the viewer experience. So these programmes use a very large number of cameras strategically positioned out in the forest or out in the countryside, constantly capturing to try to catch footage of animals in their natural habitats. And the output of those cameras is either streamed live or recorded. So viewers can essentially sit across a stream of, for example, the badger set and watch the activity that's happening in their live. But there is a very large number of cameras gathering a lot of footage around the clock. And those cameras are just sitting and looking and waiting for subjects who themselves are not predictable in when they might appear. So actually gathering useful and usable content from those cameras is really labor intensive. With so many cameras, even if you have a number of zoologists watching a rack of cameras for 24 hours a day, things can easily be missed. So BBC R&D trained an AI model to help. What they did firstly was they trained the model to recognize species by analyzing the video from those cameras. The system will recognize when there was an animal in frame and whether it's a bird or a mammal. So really basic at the first step. And from that information, it will timestamp when that animal has entered and left the frame. And it will send that off to a second AI model, which can recognize the species of the animal. And it's in things like garden birds, it's been proven to have a really high level of accuracy. And of course, there is lots of material from a backlog of those programs owned by the BBC for training that system. And the information is used in a number of ways. It can sound an alarm to tell a zoologist or a member of the production team to pay attention to a particular camera, or it can use the data associated with when an animal entered and left the frame to create a clip And that clip can then be marked for the attention of the production team. And the other type of AI that's being used in those nature programs is audio recognition. So the AI model in this case is trained to recognize and flag unwanted sounds, such as vehicle noises or human voices near a camera where the audio is being streamed live. And it can send that information that there is undesirable noise happening so that the choice can be made to temporarily stop a stream. And this is a real help for producers in terms of compliance and just keeping the content that's being broadcast safe for viewers. And the AI has even been trained to predict animal behavior. It was trained to provide information about when a clutch of shell duck eggs were going to hatch. And it could do this based on the behavior of the adult shell ducks changing. They were entering and exiting their nest more often as the eggs got closer to hatching. So all of that is great for editorial teams, really useful. But it can also be used to provide extra content directly to audiences. So it's been used already to provide interesting stats on behaviours of birds at feeders, because it can analyse how long certain species will stay to feed or which species are visiting a feeder the most often. And that's been used as part of the content in the live broadcasts. It can also prompt text to animate on live streams to identify species for viewers. And if that's not enough, it can also generate chapter heads on recordings of streamed clips. So if a viewer is a really big goldfinch fan, they can jump between points in a clip featuring goldfinches. So I think this is a really good example of an incredible way that BBC R&D have found to bring lots of extra value and content to audiences where AI is really heavily assisting in the editorial processes.
Yeah, I love this. And then very interested in how you kind of train a custom model around that particular type of content, which I guess probably significantly enhances the accuracy of it compared to something more generic. Okay, and there's one last use case that I want to touch on, which is something I know is a bit more sort of on the drawing board at the moment, not yet in production. But tell us what you're doing with the BBC orchestras.
Yeah, so all of this feeds into ideas that we've been brainstorming about how we can combine our studio automation systems with machine learning and AI to bring more value to audiences during certain types of our coverage. So the BBC has a number of orchestras, and on two of our sites, the home of the BBC Philharmonic and the home of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, we use a really high degree of studio automation to generate live streams of concerts. And we've been talking for a while about how we can add value for viewers to these streams. So outside of the realms of AI, we had already been working on providing alternative content streams of concerts, where we would use studio automation to supply interesting facts and stats about the coverage at opportune moments during a concert. So for example, we might interview a conductor before a concert and find out why they are taking a certain part of a piece at a certain speed, or why they are sustaining pauses in a certain way, or what they are doing with the dynamics. And what we have been working on is then using the studio automation, which is controlling a timeline of the shots for the music coverage, to fire graphics carrying this extra information at opportune moments in the piece. And other things we've thought about in the same vein with this is player and conductor stats. So how long first oboe has played for this orchestra, how many times they have performed this piece, how many times they have worked with this conductor. And this is where the AI could come in. So where you've got a long summer season with lots of concerts featuring the same orchestra, you could use AI face and instrument recognition to bring up those player stats based on who is in the frame. And you could combine that form of recognition with the information in the automation timeline to make sure you bring the graphics up at the optimal time. So for example, if the AI knows that it has the conductor in the frame and the automation system knows that this shot is going to be 30 seconds long. With that information put together, it can be calculated that now is a good time to bring up some extra background information about the conductor. Now, like I say, this is all just brainstorming at the moment, but hopefully you can see the potential of this for music coverage. And equally for things like sporting events, this sort of technology could really bring extra content to viewers, or for wider BBC events coverage. You know, for example, during a military parade, if the AI recognises the Royal Company of Archers, it could bring up facts about the Royal Company of Archers on an alternative content stream. So there is a lot to think about. The possibilities are a bit overwhelming, but they are also incredibly exciting.
Yeah, and I love talking about these just because, you know, we hear about AI and content creation. I think brains go straight to sort of generative AI and writing scripts and creating images and all of that kind of thing. But I love how you're using AI in sort of creative ways to improve the program making process and the viewer experience, just in slightly different ways. So thank you very much, Morag. I really appreciate you talking us through those, and I look forward to seeing some more of the fruits of that on screen soon.
That was the BBC's Morag McIntosh, and before that, Atelier CTO Ryan Kido, both in conversation with the DPP's Rowan de Pomeroy. Thank you for listening. If you haven't done so already, then immediately check out part one for more insights from Avid CTO Kevin Riley and Google Product Manager Malika Golkaram. We look forward to sharing more with you soon on the DPP podcast.